reason why it's so important for me to have this event tonight was years ago, when I started getting more involved in religion, I went through quite a bit of a phenomenon where I noticed I'd hear Abel Appin say something, which made a lot of sense. But then I'd go out into other areas or into Israel, and someone would say the exact opposite. Or we'd be doing the exact opposite. And you start thinking, well, what's going on here? Rabbi Lappin says this, they say that. Rabbi Lappin sounds logical, but they are numbering me. And then I heard about the Yeshiva, and I heard the Rosh Yeshiva and the Rabbim say the exact same thing as Rabbi Lappin was saying, and the normality of it. So I said, well, obviously there's a way of being like this. And I just wanted Rabbi Lappin to share some ideas with us.
Thanks, Brady. And I haven't prepared to say anything specific. I think it might be more interesting to deal with some of the issues that are on your minds. I think one of the challenges that faces you is the following. The yeshiva really faces a challenge which is caused by its strength and its weakness. The strength of the yeshiva, or one of the strengths of the yeshiva, is that the Rosh Yeshiva Rabbi Goldfein was absolutely unmovable on retaining not just the essence of what Torah was in his experience, but everything about it. So he told me once, I'm sure you heard him, I'm sure he told it to you too, about a Chinese guy who lives in the yeshivas in Chinatown there, just about, isn't it? So there was some Chinese guy that said to him that he left China a while back and came to South Africa and with his family, and he's been very dedicated to communism the way he grew up. It's a great ideal and wonderful, and he's raised his children that this is the way it's meant to be. Don't take any notice of all the capitalism around you, just stay faithful to the way we were. And then he took his family back for a visit to China, and he finds there's nobody there like him. And his kids said, what is this? You kept on talking about China and communism, and it's more capitalist in China than it is in South Africa. So Rabbi Goldfein said, I feel a bit like that. I left Tells, and I brought Tells to South Africa, and then I go back to Tells, and it's not there anymore. And really, the yeshiva is a bit of a fossil. And a fossil is an important thing, because a fossil keeps you aware of how things were. The trouble is, it's okay to look at a fossil in a museum, but when you are the fossil, it becomes quite challenging. When you go out into the world and people kind of look at you strange and say, oh, I thought dinosaurs were just in history books. And so I would imagine that certainly when you go out into the wider Torah world, there's some serious challenges that face you. The kind of challenges Bradley was just talking about. Are they right or are we right? Are we both right? Is there a right and wrong? What do I do? Do I become like them or do I stay like me? If I stay like me, I probably won't get a job and I'll have no friends. If I become like them, then am I compromising my essence and my integrity? And what do I really do? So I thought maybe that might be some starting point to speak about, if that's something that you think is relevant to you. Let's start off and get some thoughts around the table, and let's start off on that, and then we'll branch out maybe to some other things. But let's start off with that. What thoughts and feelings are going around? Yep.
Just with regards to this point, I mean, at the end of the day, we are seeing people from, I'm going to say the other side, but from the other end of the scale. And like, if it would be ignorance to have those people like don't know at all what they're talking about. I mean, we do have some people there who are very, very big Talmidei Chachamim. Like, there's no doubt they come from a line of Talmidei Chachamim. But they come in. Seem to be saying some things which aren't, I mean, not at all in like what we're saying. So how do you relate to? I mean, like, it's obviously still to respect them because they are talking like a comment. But how do you relate to them and say that? Okay, look, the way we've been taught is right, and I trust
I can have some faith in Rosh Hashiva and what he says. I know he'd never say anything. But at the same time, like, it might be that there, like, I wonder if there is a bit of a broader scale. Because we are dealing with individuals who aren't just guys off the street. And you are akin to Shas, and they've been around. So how do we equate, like, from that aspect?
Have you got an example? I'm not asking about the specific person, about the kind of thing that a Talmud Chacham could be saying that causes you to the stress you're talking, the tension you're talking about. So what you're saying is you can't assume that anybody who isn't like you is an Amoret, because the fact is you see a lot of very big Talmud Chachamim who are not like you, and so how do you relate to them? Are there any specific examples of the kind of thing that they would be saying that is in conflict with the things that you're taught? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Well, specifically with regards to wear of dress, with regards to being a lot more secluded, with regards to having a lot more, like, impatience for other people, and not necessarily putting people first. Where we would be taught in
the ship. Okay, so you're touching on a few things, and let's deal with them. The one you're talking about is dress, appearance. The second thing you said was, what was the second thing? It's, you said tolerance of people and
seclusion.
And seclusion.
And I suppose the third thing would be just our general approach to halacha.
Well, let's come to that later. Let's start.
Yeah, just difference. Ways of learning Gemara.
Tarachei Limud would be different. Yeah. So let's try and work through some of them. It's not the first time that challenge exists. That's the first thing you need to know. After all, that was the issue with Misnagdim and Hasidim. So when Misnagdim were raised in very closed Misnagdisha communities, you can imagine the first time they met a Hasidish Rebbe who was a Bochi B'Shas. And Poskim and Kupaskin, and that must have been quite shaking too. So what does that mean? Are they right? Are they not right? So encountering somebody who's different from you, but no less great and maybe greater, is not a new phenomenon. But let's try and work out how to deal with it. Firstly, as far as dress is concerned, where does dress fit into halacha? It doesn't. Apart from Hilchot Sneas, that on Shabbos you should wear a big day covered, that when you daven you should to be dressed in a certain kind of a way. Dress is a matter of style and fashion. And I think what you've got to realize is that I'm going to call it the Haredi world, because that's probably the word that people understand the best. But it's important when we use that term Haredi world that we understand it's a world. You can't box them. They're big. They're big not just in numbers, but the Haredi world just spans from, I guess, just a little bit further than where you are to all the way to the other end. So it's a very, very wide world with a lot of people in it that are going through a lot of different things and holding at all sorts of different levels. So the Haredi world is a society, and it always used to be. If you look at the old Shailos and Tshuvos, they were written for Haredim, isn't that so? Who would go to the Chasam Sofer with a Shaila? Who would go to the Noda B'Yuda with a Shaila? Not some Apikuras. They were all Talmidei Chachamim. They were all people from certainly from homes. If they weren't Talmidei Chachamim, they were all from homes. And look at the Shailos and Tshuvos, some of them. They're pretty scary, some of them. Some of them are in Lomdish areas, but you've got questions of theft sometimes. You've got questions of adultery. You've got all sorts of weird things. So what kind of society is this? The answer is it's a society like any society. A society has great people in it, and a society has ganovim in it, and a society has drunkards in it, and a society has addicts in it, and a society has adulterers in it. That's what a society has. A good society has a small proportion of the bad stuff and a high proportion of the good. A bad society, it's the other way around, but any society has it all. And whereas after the war, and that's probably the difference between the world you're dealing with at the moment and the Torah world I dealt with when I went to yeshiva, is when I went to yeshiva, the frum world was not a society. The frum world was a community. The international frum world was a community. It was small. It was very, very small. In Johannesburg, it was a few families. In Eretz Israel, how many people were learning in yeshiva when I was in yeshiva? A few thousand. That's all it was. Bonavish was about 400. Mir was about 200. Hebron was about 400. Those were the big yeshivas. And there was Slabotka and Chassidim and Ber Yaakov and so on. I'm just talking the Litvish world. And there was the Hasidish world. But in the Litvish world, it was a couple of thousand. You actually got to know everybody. You'd go for a Shabbos to Ber Yaakov, you'd go to a Shabbos to Hebron, you'd go for a few Shabbos to Ponovich. It didn't take very long, but you kind of were one of the guys, meaning the yeshiva world. It wasn't a world, it was very small. I'm not familiar with what the American world was at that time, because it was only many years later when I first went to America. But Lakewood wasn't a huge place. Tells wasn't a huge place. And Neri Israel wasn't a huge place. And there weren't a whole lot of others. There were other small places, but not a whole lot. So the Torah, it wasn't a world, it was a community. If you weren't aligned with the values of the Gedolim of that time, then you weren't in the community. You were doing something else. And who were the Gedolim of that time? It was also just a handful of people. But those were all Gedolim and Rosh Hashivas who were, if not themselves, people who learnt in Europe, Talmidim of people who learnt in Europe. Every Rosh Hashiva at that time, his Rebbe, most of them themselves had been in Europe. My Rebbe was a Talmid of Reb Shimon Shkol. Most of the big Rosh Hashivas at that time were Talmidim of Rosh Hashivas in Europe. So they saw Torah at its greatest. The next generation of Rosh Hashivas didn't. The next Rosh Hashivas already are Klishlishi from Eastern Europe. So there were a few great Rosh Hashivas. And you could have access to them. It wasn't very difficult for me as a young yeshiva bocher to go and have a shmooze with Reb Shmuel Rozovsky in Ponovich. You know, you'd listen to a shir of his, you'd go up to him afterwards, he would talk to you, invite you over for Shabbos. That was a very small, it was a community. And nobody expected to see what has happened. And that's something I think you've also got to realize, is that nobody certainly, I don't think anybody, I certainly didn't, and I've been quite good at kind of predicting trends. I was completely wrong when it came to the Torah trends. Certainly to the scale of it. It's far beyond anything that I imagined, and I don't think anybody imagined that. After Eastern Europe, after the destruction of Eastern Europe at the end of the Second World War, many people wondered whether there would be anything other than a few yechidim. It appears from things that Moshe Ben Soloveitchik has said, that the reason he started the modern Orthodox movement and really got involved with Yeshiva University, because he thought that's all there would be. If you didn't do that, there wouldn't be anything. Some people had a greater vision. Ponovizhirov kind of did have a vision, but I don't know if he had a vision of this. So one needs to understand that then, and I'm talking now not right out to the want, or even when I was yeshiva, so we're talking about the 60s, 70s even, that wasn't a long time ago. The Torah world was a community. Today the Torah world is a society. So that's the first change that's taken place. When did Rabbi Goldfein come to South Africa? What year must have been? The 70s, is that right?
78.
So he left the overseas Torah world when it was still a community.
Before that, the yeshiva started in
70. Yeah, but he was at yeshiva college for a few years before that. Yeah, I think it must have been about 73 or 72 or 73 that he came. So even he left the Torah world, it was a community. And he built what he built over here. But meanwhile, that community ceased to be a community and started becoming a world. And it's really very accelerated. So if you think of the United States. How many of these guys came over? What were they called, the guys that came over on the Mayflower and all of that? I mean, how many people came over in the beginning? A few hundred people. So they had communities. Imagine fast forwarding from those little things to a country of 300 million people. Imagine that just took place relatively quickly. And I imagine you still kind of think of America as it was when it was a community. And you haven't quite twigged on that it's not a community anymore, it's now a nation. That's the kind of change. So I'm not suggesting, yet we're not coming onto the question of do you need to change. What all that's important is to appreciate that there has been an absolute nuclear change in the nature of the Torah world over the last 30 or 40 years. And that's the first one. So when we talk about the Haredi world, we're talking about a world. We're not talking about a group of people bound by a common philosophy. They don't have a common philosophy. Kind of, sort of. What is the, if I were to ask you, what's the common philosophy of the Haredi world? What is it?
It should be the Torah.
Torah, fine. But they're not the only ones so that doesn't define them. Subservience to the Shulchan Aruch. Fine. So the Hasidim, so do the Dati Lumi, so do lots of people. Modern Orthodox, there are lots of people who accept Shulchan Aruch. So what defines them?
More Chumridik.
I know some incredibly big Machmirim who are Dati Lumi in the army. They're amazingly Machmir. And Machmir design. There are lots of Haredim who are very makel when nobody's looking. And some are making it even if they are. It's not. Does that really define them? What defines them?
And it would be the struggle of your isolation.
Yeah, it's a little bit like people say Americans are isolated. They don't know what's going on in the rest of the world. And I say always when people say that, I say, you know, you would have realized.
The whole world's America.
Yeah, America kind of is a world. America's 50 countries. For them to know what's happening in 50 states is pretty much more than the average South African who knows what's happening maybe in England and in Europe as a kind of a whole. We kind of know what's happening in 6 or 7 countries and we think we're global. But they just to know what's going on in America, they almost take the view of who cares what's happening in the rest of the world. It's kind of irrelevant. So the Haredi world is big, it's dominant, it's vibrant, and insular. So what are they insular from?
From secularism.
They're insular from secularism. Okay, so maybe there's a bit of an insularity. That's changing, by the way. And we can talk about that aspect of it also for a long time, but we can talk about the insularism and what that means and where it comes from and why it's there and its value. But it's also changing because this world has become so big that people are going out and working now. So in Lakewood Yeshiva, there's now a lot of people who are going out and learning computers. They're going out and learning different skills, accounting and things like that, realizing that they're going to need to take jobs. So there is the beginning of an opening to that. And one has to realize also that a lot of these insulated guys are getting top jobs in businesses in America. And some of them are making a fortune of money in their own businesses. So we can say insulated, 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 but they come out of insulation when they need to and they're kind of doing quite well. So maybe insulated isn't such a bad thing. But we'll talk about the insulation, but maybe that defines them. At the end, it's countries are defined by geography, by where they live. And this world, called the Haredi world, is defined by a commitment to Torah, but there are people who are committed to Torah that are not part of the Haredim. Really, I suppose they're defined by the clothes they wear at the end of the day. What is the real difference between a Haredi and a non-Haredi, whatever that means? A guy, two people, both committed to Torah mitzvahs. Maybe one goes to the army, the others. Now they're Haredim going to the army in Israel too. So that's less of a separation. So what's really separating? Is it the way they dress and whether their kids have got payers or not? Is that what does it all? To a large extent, yes. In which case, you've got to start realizing that the Haredim are a world of people who conform to certain fashion requirements. They conform to a lot more than that too, but so do others. What I'm saying is their commitment to Torah mitzvahs is not unique to them. I can't think of a whole lot that is unique to the Haredi world other than their dress. What else is unique? Do you say they have a different style of learning? There are people in that world that have your style of learning. And there are people in your world that have their style of learning. So I don't think the style of learning differentiates. What differentiates? And therefore, when you start looking at the clothing issue, just treat it as fashion. In their world, that's the fashion. And it's not a value judgment, it's just fashion. That's all it is. They're not saying, there's no way they can say, this is what is halakhically required. They can't even say this is the tradition, because you know from the pictures in the book you had on the table a few moments ago that that's not the tradition. It was the tradition in parts of Eastern Europe, but not in other parts of Eastern Europe. So it's not even an old Masoira or anything like that. It's just a fashion. Who started the fashion? Who knows? Like most fashions, some kid. I don't know who started the fashion. It doesn't matter who started the fashion. It was just a fashion. And did the Rosh Hashivas in days of old dress up like that? I guess they did. So what the fashion is now for everybody to dress the way that Rosh Hashivas used to dress. That's the fashion. And what did Rosh Hashivas do? They dress the same. So now in clothing you can't tell if a guy's a Rosh Hashiva or an Amoritz. So it's a very egalitarian fashion. We all dress the same. It's a little bit like, you'll find that in some Dati Lumi areas where you'll go into a yeshiva, the Rosh Hashiva is wearing sandals without socks and a kippah sruga, short sleeve shirt and a pair of jeans, and he's a big Talmid Chacham, so you can't tell the difference between the Rosh Hashiva and the boys. Well, in the Haredi world you also can't tell the difference between the Rosh Hashiva and the boys. Everybody dresses the same. It's just part of it's a uniformity. So there's a certain safety that a lot of people find in that kind of uniformity. It declares who I am, I'm a part of this group of people, and they feel okay with it. So what's important with fashion is just not to get judgmental about it. It shouldn't bother you. You know, you dress how you want, let them dress how you want, and as long as you don't place any value judgment and don't think that because a person dresses in a certain way, you can say a whole lot other than their covered abrius, whether they show respect to the people around them, because to dress in a way, well, let's put it this way, if you went to learn in a very Haredi yeshiva, how should you dress?
Okay.
Yeah, you've got to dress like them. If there's any halacha, that's the cheretz. That's where you're at. That's the fashion. If you go to work in a corporation where they wear ties all day, then you do that. As long as the fashion isn't compromising who you are or the halacha, you do what people are doing. That's what you do. It's only fashion. It's not serious. So it's very important not to make a big deal of it and not to let it make a big deal of you. And let it not define you, and let it not define them, and certainly let it not define either a superiority or an inferiority complex. It's just fashion. That's all the clothing is. And you've got to be very, very clear about that. So it's all very well I'm telling you this, but there are thousands and thousands of other people out there who might not know that, and they might look at you, who doesn't wear a big black hat, that therefore you obviously can't be very serious about your Torah, and you've got to be able to laugh that off. Just say, it's like someone saying you're not wearing a Pierre Cardin suit or whatever the fashion at the moment, you're not wearing an Armani suit, so clearly you're not a very good banker. You know, you look at your millions in your bank account and you say it's fine, what does bother you? It's irrelevant, it's just irrelevant. The question of seclusion. So yes, I suppose the Haredi world as such has taken a view of limiting themselves to their own world, and that's an approach. Is it the right approach, the wrong approach? Who knows? It depends on the individuals. But it's a valid approach. It's an approach of saying just there's too much going on, there's too much distraction, and that's what they want to do. The question is that today seclusion is not really an option anymore. Just because of the nature of technology and the world and globalization, it's you can't really be secluded anymore. So they've got a challenge to deal with. What is their response going to be? Some of them still think their children are secluded. Some of them know that they're no longer secluded. What are they going to deal? How are they going to deal with it? I think the real challenge is when you experience among, in this case, that group or any group, an irrationalization, if there's such a word, an irrationalism, and an intolerance of being able to discuss an idea, that becomes a bit of a problem. The speed with which, and I don't want to say they, because again, I'm not talking about the Haredi world. There are thousands and thousands of people in the Haredi world who are just like you. They just dress differently. They think like you, they learn like you, they believe like you, they do like you. thousands and thousands of people like that. Don't look at this kind of sea of black hats and black suits and white shirts and say, there's nobody like me, look at them. And there are lots like you. Maybe even the majority of people your age are like you. Maybe even that. Some have the courage to talk about it, some don't. Some will talk to you about it when you engage in them and they trust you. Some never will. Some aren't like you. But so I don't even like talking about them. It's us. It doesn't make any difference. We've got to get into our heads that the only thing that divides us is our clothing. That's all that divides us. Now, within the Haredi world, there are lots of more subtle divisions. Now you'll find people whose Derech HaLimud is like yours, and some whose Derech HaLimud is very different. There you'll find people who'll take a more open approach, and people who'll take a more close. So the differences that you should be experiencing and talking about is not us versus the Haredim. You know what, guys? You are Haredim. You are. What? I don't know what's the difference. In what way are you not Haredim? Other than your clothes. I don't know what way you're not Haredim. You are Haredim. Are you not Haredim by Hashem? You don't keep Torah Milah. You're Haredim. So I think you've got to stop seeing the Haredim and us. You're Haredim. Get that into it. I'm also a Haredim. Now,
some of us also learn a sefer called Sefer Haredim.
Learn the Sefer Haredim. Now, if you want to learn, I'm sure you've got in the yeshiva the, what's it called? Enayim Liris? You've got the Sefer Enayim Liris in the yeshiva. The English version. You've got the English version. It's a little sensitive. I have to see that. So that's a Haredi guy. And he's very critical about certain things. But he's in the Haredi camp. And it's okay to be that. So I think it would be important for you to stop seeing them as Haredim and you as, I don't know what you would call it. They're Haredim. What are you?
We're Jewish.
Rabbi,
what's also the source of the word Haredi, to classify a group as Haredi?
Haredi Hashem, we tremble at Hashem's will. That's what Haredi means. We take Hashem seriously. You take Hashem seriously. So you're Haredi. The only thing is you have a different fashion. Your fashion sense is different. And then there are a few ideological differences, but not between you and all Haredi. Between you and some Haredi. And there are lots of Haredim who like you. So I think it's an important transition that you need to go through in not dividing the world by the way they dress. Get to know people better. And you will find people like you that dress differently. And you will find people like you that dress like you that aren't like you. In business, I explain often that diversity, because that's a big issue around the world at the moment, diversity isn't about how different people look. It's about how different people see. That's what should define difference. Get beyond how they look and get into the how they see. And find people who see the world like you. Doesn't matter how they dress. And you will find among the Haredi many people who see the world like you. And some, as I say, will be critical of the communities in which they live, and some will be accepting of the communities that they live in. And there will be many who don't see the world like you, and we'll come on to that in a moment. But the first thing I just want to try and establish is, don't divide the world into people who look different and people who look like you. Let's divide the world into people who see different and people who see the world like you. Yeah.
Sir, I just wanted to fully agree with the Rabbi. I mean, usually go to a shul that's usually associated with Haredi. I might go to Orson Mav, usually. I wear a black jacket on there, but I fully agree with the Rabbi. It's exactly as the Rabbi says. I associate with boys who are so-called Haredi, but that's exactly as the Rabbi says.
Yeah, it's not it shouldn't be the issue. The issue is deeper than that. The issue is more subtle than that.
Just and a difference maybe in thought. One of the main subjects that the Rosh Hashiva would constantly deal with was Derech Eretz and Midas Tovos, which what I've seen of the Haredi world, is not a something that they focus on completely.
But you see, you're falling into the trap of them and they, and who exactly are you speaking about, and how many Haredi people do you know? And what I would say is that in that community, there are very few places and people who focus as much on Ben Adam Lechaver as your Rosh Hashiva did and the current Rosh Hashivas do. But there are places and individuals. And I think perhaps one of the big differences also is that both because of the size of the yeshiva and the control the Rosh Yeshiva had over the yeshiva, you're a yeshiva of individuals. Whereas in the big world, wide world out there, it's trends and it's fashion and it's flows and it's massive institutions. So it's much more difficult to focus on the things that which doesn't make it okay. But you could have a conversation with anybody in the Haredi world and they would agree with you about that. They just don't practice, they don't do it. And again, who's the day? There are many people who are unbelievable Ben on the Chavira. And you must be careful not to get into a frame of mind where as soon as you see a black hat, you assume that he's not a Ben on the Chavira guy. It's just a very big community. And as I say, not community, it's just a big world. And in that world, there are communities that focus on Ben on the Chavira. There are yeshivas that do. And there are individuals that do. But it's not the main thing. Well, it's not the main thing anywhere. What country focuses on Ben Adam L'Chaveru? No country does. You've got to think of the Haredim as a country. There are probably more Haredim now than there were Jews in Israel when Israel started out. It's a little country. It's a nationality. And nations, it's very difficult to get into Midas when you're dealing with vast numbers such as that. You've got to kind of look for the individuals that are like you. But Rebellion Lockman, do you think Rebellion didn't speak about Midas and Ben Adam L'Chaveru? The minag that you see around very often when people wash their hands and they fill the cup for the next person. That was Rebellion Lockman's thing. He taught that. That was his little innovation. He brought that into the modern world and now it's all over the place. Everybody washes and they fill the cup up for the next guy. He didn't mean that to be the only Ben Adam L'Chaveru that you do, but he just meant it to be one of the things that you do. He was a Haredi kind of a guy. In a Haredi kind of a yeshiva, and there are many, so we must just be careful not to stereotype, Moshe.
Once we've made almost a quantum leap into we're all one people in terms of, it was very easy before I came here tonight, or anybody else probably came here tonight, to say this differentiates us from the view that we might have had of them, because clearly the view that we had of them to our people like Chigger. I don't even know what his first name is. Whatever his name is talking about. There are people like that, and those are the most visible people, are the people that push you out of lines in Kiddush, you know what I mean? When you're trying to go reach for something, and they take all the food from your plate. And it was very easy before to say, no, he's a Haredi, he dresses with a black hat, and has a stain on his shirt, that makes him Haredi. But now, if we're all the same, and assume maybe we dress the same, if we go to the, you know, a Haredi place, what differentiates us? Is it only our ideas? Is it our midas? I mean,
that was always that's all the Torah thing. That what differentiates you is something inside you. That and yes, that it will manifest in the way you engage with people. It will manifest as anybody gets to know you. It will manifest in the way you think and in the way you learn. But it differentiates you as a yeshiva in terms of the values. So, you know, people will start getting it eventually that they've met 25 people from the yeshiva. And they all have good midas. So the yeshiva gets a name as a place for good midas. When I went to Kfar Hasidim, it had the name of the best place for Ben Adam L'Chaveru. Because Rebellion was very makbid on that. Didn't mean the other places weren't Haredi, or the other places were Haredi and Kfar Hasidim wasn't. But it did have a name. Everybody knew that Ben Adam L'Chaveru at Kfar Hasidim was exceptional, was amazing. Does that mean there weren't some guys there who were pretty bad at it? Of course there were. And that there weren't some guys in other yeshivas who were amazing at it? Absolutely there were. But there was a yeshiva that had a reputation for that. So your yeshiva will have a reputation for a certain derech halimud and for a focus on Ben Adam L'Chaveru and a certain style and personality. But that's an institutional thing. That's how yeshiva is. You're not a tribe. You're a yeshiva.
But I think originally the reason that some people were so much that you differentiate on, say, for example, how people look. That's very easy. In this day and age, you're interacting with so many different people. How does that make you? You can't sit and talk to everybody and discuss the points that make you, you know, different to you.
Yeah, but that's like the role of stereotyping. There is a place for stereotyping. And the place for stereotyping is only for the purpose of initial assumption. So if you're going to a place that you've never been before, if you go to Germany and I say to you, when you do business in Germany, call everybody by their last names. That's a stereotype, because in Germany that's what you do. So that's a stereotype. And you might find that very helpful. And then you leave Germany and you go to the United States, and I say, in the United States, if somebody introduces them by their first name, if you call them by their first name right away, even if it's the chief executive of a large corporation, that's how he introduces himself, and that's what you do. And that's stereotyping, and that's very helpful. But you've got to be able to move off the stereotype very quickly. So if you meet a German guy and he says to you, "No, call me Hans," and you say, "No, Rabbi Lappin said I must call you by your last name because you're German," that's stupid. And vice versa. You've got to be able to move off a stereotype. So if you want to start with a stereotype and say, in many other yeshivas, the focus on Ben Odom L'Chavero is not as much as it is in ours, that's fine. So now you go there and you kind of know what to expect. But that doesn't mean that you engage with each person expecting to be weak in the Ben Adam L'Chaver, because all of a sudden you find people who are El Tzaddikim. And that's fine. So it's a style of a yeshiva. It's a style of a yeshiva that has the imprint of its Rosh Yeshiva and their Mesoira. And that's fine, but it doesn't. Was Tel's yeshiva so differentiated from the other yeshivas? Yes, it was in its style. It wasn't its Derech HaLimud and the kind of boy it produced. Everybody could tell the difference between a Slabotka boy and a Tel's boy. But they weren't like Derech Haredim and we're something else. The Muslims were all B'nai Torah, all the Yeshiva B'nai Torah. So I think it's important, it'll make life much easier for you to start, once you get over the initial shock of it, is that you're Haredim too. You have a different fashion sense and you have a Derech HaLimud and a way of dealing with stuff that you've learned from your Rosh Yeshiva. But that doesn't make you that different.
Rabban, very draining is, I think it's always in the Baltribal world, there's always a lack of respect for the Rabbanim of yesteryear. But certain Rabbanim don't even quote. Yet they were Gyoelim and the many Rabbanim who, almost all is always written off. God forbid you quote that role. And he was quite a serious weight in his generation. How do you deal with that?
You don't. So it's their choice who they quote. And
no, but you hold by.
So you hold. So hold.
Literally, has always had a hell of a covert for the Rabbanim of Litter. The Ramoshi Feinsteins, the Aruch HaShulchans, etc. Yet today it's almost a. No, don't even quote them.
So? You're going into a Hasidic yeshiva and they'll quote Hasidic sources and Hasidic rabbi. They'll come into yours and they'll
come of
yesteryear or whatever, they'll come into our yeshivas and say, "Gee, interesting, yeah, I don't hear you quoting Chassidish Rabbein." No, it's not our tradition. It doesn't make... These are things, I think one has to distinguish between a Mesoira and things that are much bigger than that. So, and the important thing is not to get hit up about it. So what? Do they quote the people they were taught and that they were taught to respect? What you can be offended for, I suppose, is if somebody shows disrespect to somebody who was a god or just because they're not of the same. So then you engage in a discussion about the basis of that disrespect is and that you find it offensive. And you say to the other person, it's not because they're Haredi and you're not, you just say, "I find the way you spoke about so-and-so very offensive." That's how you feel. But not to allow these things to become divisions. You don't want these things to be divisions. You want to know who you are, be proud of who you are, and secure in who you are, without having to divide the world into a them and us.
Just on the same point of how the dress comes in, but one thing that I do notice a lot when it comes to our community, and especially living in a Western world, is that when you, lots of the people, as you're trying to McCabe, look, I don't know, many speak about South Africans, but if one person had to meet the Rosh Hashiva, like everyone who met the Rosh Hashiva here, everyone thinks he's a mensch. You hear people who weren't religious talking about him, you see a mensch, and everyone, when you see a mensch, you want your kids to be like him. But when someone had to, if you had to approach a person like that and you had to say, "Is this person religious? Do you think he's pious?" Everyone would say, because he doesn't, I think the Western approach is he's got to be different. You got to be, if you're different to me, if you look different, then you can be something that I'm not. Otherwise, it's otherwise people, it's a stereotype, but it's projection. They like me because he looks like me. So there is an element that he's a mensch, but he doesn't look like a god, or he can't be. So when people are becoming vultures and they want to become religious, no one wants to come to, I would say, our brand in a sense. It's because, yeah, we are mentioned, but we can't be the thing, because we're not any different. So how would a person, if a person wanted to make someone, how would we give that over? Because living in the Western world, I think that's such a hindrance that they're just getting bombarded with. You have to be different every single day. How do you approach situations like that? You don't see people when they become religious today. Everyone comes to that, like the rabbi said, we are Haredi, but they become to they join that approach.
Yeah, that's a hard question, and I discussed that with Rabbi Goldman on a number of occasions. He didn't think that he could have more influence if he dressed the part and played the game. And part of the reason I think that he didn't, I spoke about at the Shloshim. And I think there are other things too. I think he was concerned that he would, I think, that some of his concern was that if the difference, if his yeshiva boys just became like everybody else externally, it would be harder for him to educate them to be different internally. And he saw the need to educate them to be different internally. And I think that's why one of the reasons that he chose that route. It does leave you with that disadvantage. If you're not playing the part, then you've got to actually overcome the assumptions and the natural resistances. And you'll only do that by engaging people. So you actually have to take people through the thinking. But then not only does it become an issue of they don't want to accept you or your Rosh Hashivas as the Talmidei Chachomim that they are, not only because they don't appreciate who they are because they don't dress the part, but even if they do appreciate, now it becomes, but I don't want my friend to think that I've lost the plot because I think he's a godel, when you can see by the way he dresses that he can't be a godel. So you do limit the market. And Rabbi Goldfein's view was, fine, so I'll limit the market. I would rather work with the small market who's on the... And that's part of a decision that you have to make, that either you're confident that who you are is so authentic that it comes through, and people who want authenticity will be attracted to it, and people who want the shtick will go to the shtick. Or you feel that there's a need to kind of package in order to bridge that gap. But it becomes really a strategy of expedience. And as long as you know that's why you're doing it, so let's say you decide you're going to become a rov somewhere, or you're going to become a magid shirin somewhere, and you decide you're going to play the part, as long as you know that that's what you're doing. I have a cousin who was a Rosh Hashiva in Eretz Yisrael, now he's a Rosh Hashiva elsewhere, and I remember seeing him one day, and he was wearing like a real Rosh Hashiva, a big hat, long coat. And then I saw him on Shabbos, and he was wearing a light suit and short, in Yerushalayim, nice stylish hat. And I said to him, Reb Sensa, I went to his name because I didn't know who he is. I said, I kind of saw you the other day, and you looked all yeshivish. He says, yeah, but not on Shabbos, that's my working clothes. that's for my job. So as long as you understand, if you decide to dress up for the part, as long as you understand that that's what you're doing, that's fine. You're dressing for fashion, that's okay. You go to Or Samach, so you dress like they do in Or Samach, it's a fashion. So you're dressing, as long as you know that. You decide to grow payas and a long beard because you want to not have to take 2 years to persuade somebody that you're a Talmid Chochem. You would like them to think that you're... I don't know why people think that, because there are lots of Lamaratzim dressed up. You're right, they do. I think if you've got the... you must be a rabbi, you must be... Yeah, that's what they think. Well, even some of the Torah people think that. So if you decide that's why you're doing it, then okay, then you realize you're playing the game. It's a little bit Esavi, isn't it? I mean, that's a little bit like what Esav used to do. So it's not something that one feels comfortable with, and that's why your Shishima never wanted to go there. It just didn't feel comfortable to him. But that's something that's a choice each person must make.
Even if a person did that route, then if they had a Makarev that person, now they have to show them the true way. I mean, you've just created a facade. It's like you tricked them into becoming religious. I mean...
Yeah, then you've got a different thing to manage. Now, at some point you've got to tell them that, I needed this to trick you, can't you?
Yeah.
It's not the... Yeah, you better be careful because it's like some people in the queue of business are Makarif people with whiskey.
Yeah, I know. That's
and at some point you've got to tell them, you know, it's not really all about whiskey. And sometimes they never tell them that. And they go along their whole religious life thinking that Shabbos is about getting drunk and it's terrible.
It's terrible. Everyone Makarif in different ways. Like you'll get people that are Makarif through drink. You'll get people that are Makarif because they look different. You'll get people Makarif through Israel.
Here's the trick. The trick is to be Makarif, not just Makarif. So all your communication should be through the power of your own authenticity. However, your packaging can amplify. The way you dress amplifies. In business, they call it power dressing. So you'll find even in businesses here it's become the fashion since Mandela days to dress a little bit more casually. But when they see a client, they know how to power dress. And they do power dress. Because they realize when you're influencing somebody, the packaging is relevant. So I don't think you should ignore the power of packaging if you want to have influence. If you take the view, I don't need to have influence, I'm doing my thing, and that's it. Whoever comes, comes, whoever doesn't, then you do whatever you want to do. But if you want to expand your impact, one of the tools of impact is packaging. And all you want to be sure is that your packaging is not inauthentic to you. So you're not dressed in a way that is, you don't dress like a geir or chosid, put on a shtreimel when you really understand. That would be inauthentic. But to wear a black suit and a white shirt and a black hat, is that inauthentic? If you decide you want to do that because that's where you're operating, those are the people you want to influence, it's not a big deal.
In such a case, what's the difference? I mean, if you want to package yourself to wear a shtreimel and a monk coat, then it should be the same thing.
I guess if you want to impact in among the Geira Hasidim, and you're teaching in a Geira Hasidish school, let's say, and that's where you want to have the influence, you might take on their way of dress.
Well, I mean, they don't know the difference. They think someone is wearing a shrine.
No, but then it's different because if there is such a thing as there's a certain mode of dress still which is Hasidish, it's getting a little bit blurred, but there's still a dress which is Hasidish and there's a dress which is non-Hasidic. At least there still is.
Point, then, you don't know the difference.
You know the difference. You're dressing as a chosid when you're really a misnagid. But what are you dressing as if you put on a black suit and a black hat and a white shirt? What are you dressing as?
I'm not dressing as me.
Why not?
Because I could be dressing, because this is what I like to dress. So, if I'm
going to
put on that
kind of clothes. And if you come and work in my company, and in my company the dress code is black suits and white shirts, is that a compromise for you?
Well, whether your company, whether they respect me more, whether I wore...
Nothing to do with respect. Nothing to do with respect. We like a corporate uniform here. It's fashion. We like everybody to kind of dress so that we don't have people coming with all sorts of weird things. So we've standardized.
But that would be like the pros outweigh the cons. I mean, you can't have your individuality in your dress, but the money's worth it, so...
So you have individuality in other things. Yeah, so I say to you, I want you to be an individual. Don't express your individuality and just use your brain to express your individuality.
Maybe compromise. What I'm suggesting though is that once we're dealing with people who aren't aware of it, and aren't aware whether what's Hasidish and whether what's not Hasidish, then like, why should we...
Because you're aware. What I'm saying to you is there is no compromise to you to wear clothing that is elegant, presentable, smart, good, that anybody will stop, you know, will look at you and say, you look like a mensch. It doesn't matter, within that range, it now doesn't matter what exactly you wear, whether it's dictated. And the fact that as you get more and more into the working world, whether it's in Torah or in business, a lot of your externals are going to be dictated by fashion and by expectation of others. And it's okay within the parameters of what's acceptable to you. But the fact that what you dress is being dictated by others shouldn't be seen too much as a compromise of your individuality. Your individuality shouldn't be vested in your clothes. I don't think it's great that there's this amorphous mass of people all dressed the same. I think it's pathetic. But so what? That's what it is. That's the fashion.
I'm talking specifically in the case that we're talking about of one going to becoming a leader of some sort. And I don't want to say setting out, but in the sense setting out in order to get a greater attraction, right? In order to get more people to come to you. So
for me, wearing a black hat is, I may as well put on, I mean, it's just, it's like, it's not that it's, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I'm just saying it's just like, it's something that's not done that I see these days. I mean, I see Justin Timberlake doing it, but other than that, I don't really see how.
But I'm going to tell you that not a day goes past that somebody doesn't stop me in the street and say, gee, I like your hat. Not a day goes past. Not in the States and not here. It's often black people, but not only black people. It's often black people. But it's, and it's not often.
Edit that out of the tape.
No, I often say that, both in the States and here. It's, in the States we call black people African Americans. Yeah, they seem to like to be called black people. Whatever. So, often it is. The story I always tell, and some of you might have heard it before, is when I was a little boy, and the Ponavizhirov used to come and visit South Africa, and he used to visit our home, and I remember my father taking him to the airport. He was going back to Israel, I think it must have been, and in those days the airport was here, was just one little building. It was I don't even know which building, it's one of those buildings, but I think it was still there until recently. I don't think now it's just one little building with one little hall with some with a kind of a coffee shop and some baggage handling stuff. It was very small.
Like the ones in the country.
Yeah, I like the ones in the country still. And I remember my father stopping outside the airport and asking me to go in with the Ponavizhirov while he went to find parking. And I was terrified. I thought, I'm going to go into this airport with all these goyim sitting around there, and there's this old rabbi with a long white wig. It's going to look very weird. And you must realize, in South Africa at that time, they hadn't seen a yarmulke, never mind a beard and a Rosh Hashiva. It was just, to me, I was very self-conscious as it was about wearing a yarmulke, which I was one of the few kids in the town that wore a yarmulke at that time. I was the only kid in my school. My brother and I were the only children in the whole of King David. King David was the only school at that time who wore a kippah. My brother was expelled for wearing a kippah. That's where it was expelled for wearing a kippah. And my parents had to intervene. They'd never seen it before. Take this thing off your head. They didn't know what it was. You can't imagine what Johannesburg was. Frum kids didn't wear kippahs. Because it was so way out. So I was self-conscious enough about that kind of still to walk into the airport with this Rosh Hashiva. And I must have been very small, because I remember him taking my hand as we crossed the street. And I remember my hand being up there, so I figured out how old I was. And now he's holding my hand still, and this is getting very edgy. And I remember the feeling, and I sort of just hoped that my father would turn up before we had to actually walk into the airport building, but we didn't. And we walked in, and it was full. And as we walked in, everybody looked at us. And I thought, I know. And people just stood up. Everybody just stood up. And he was a Haredi guy with a big black hat and a long black coat. It's not about your clothes. It's about how you bear yourself. It's about who you are. It's about how you wear your clothes. It's not about the clothes. And you can wear the same items of clothing, again, as the Haredim wear, whoever they are, and you can look completely different. There's no reason why, and if you really want to do it, and you want to go to your, you know, to Armani and have your capote designed by Armani, it will look different, but you'll still qualify the Haredi with the Haredi garb, and you get yourself a nice Borsellino and an Armani suit, black hat, white shirt, a nice $400 white shirt with a beautiful Gucci tie, and you're Haredi. But you feel and look different. So it's not the clothing, it's how you carry yourself. It's how you express yourself. It's the language you use. You just open your mouth once. He used to be my science teacher when I was at school, and he became the principal of Carmel College, I think it was called, in Durban. Is that right? It was Carmel. He became the principal. One day he calls me up. We hadn't spoken for years and years. He says, they're having this, I don't know what it's called here, not graduation, what do they call them? One of these big nights. Yeah, whatever it was, night. And they always have a guest speaker, and would I come as the guest speaker? And I said, sure, that would be lovely. So I think it's like, you know, you kind of get together and the kids get some certificates like it used to be at the Yeshiva College. And he calls me back. He said, I thought I'd better tell you, that's not like that. This is like really serious, and we've got professors there, and we've got all the heads of the different religions come, and the mayor comes, and this is like a big deal for Durban. So please come in your academic gowns. I said, come on, John, you know that I don't have academic gowns. What do you mean? He said, oh, please, you've got to have something. Do something. Come with something. Can't just not. So I scratched my head. So I figured out, okay, I'll go with my Shabbos. In those days, I used to wear a Shabbos kapot as my work clothes. And a Homburg hat and everything, so I go work like I used to work here, dress here. And I went in there. It was a terribly hot day, and a very, very hot night. Incredibly hot. My air conditioning had broken, and people were sweating, and it was terrible. And I had this procession, you could have marched in, and everybody in their academic gowns, and me and my kapota. And I decided I was going to speak for 2 minutes, because it was just too hot, and so I gave a 2-minute speech, and it was probably the most successful speech I've ever given. People just, they were crazy, they loved it. So I said to him afterwards, I said, "Why? What was so good about it?" Still, first it was short, that was good. He said, "But when they saw you walked in, they thought you were a Haredi rabbi, and that you wouldn't be able to talk English. The moment you opened your mouth and you could speak English, they were just so relieved." So those are the things that differentiate you: how well you communicate, your use of language, how you bear yourself, how you sit at the table, how you eat, how you stand, your sense of fashion, even with your clothing. Style is not only a question of the color of your clothing, it's the cat. So make sure that if you're going there, I'm not suggesting everybody goes and buys a black suit tomorrow, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, if you find yourself in a situation where to have impact or to be accepted, your life will be much easier if you dress differently. So dress differently, but keep your difference as well. But you can keep your difference in other ways. There are more subtle ways that you can keep your difference, in a way that you'll walk into the room and everybody will know, this guy's different, and will want to know what the difference is. Starter will notice, will know immediately, you're different. You see, if you walk in, and again, I'm not giving you an argument for changing your clothing, I'm just saying it's not a big deal. If you walk in and you're dressed very differently, the assumption is you're from another planet. And it takes you months to get over that, if ever. If you dress the same, then the assumption is you're the same. The art is to be the same and not the same. To be sufficiently the same, in psychology it's called matching. To match people sufficiently that they feel comfortable with you, and yet to notice there's something about you that's a little different. Because it's authentic, it comes from you, it's not a game. You are different. And your difference expresses itself in everything you do. There's the same style, there's consistency in everything you do, and people start to pick that up. And they do notice. And let me tell you, the one thing in the Haredi world that is changing now, kind of the pendulum swinging the other way, is there's a lot of dissatisfaction. There's a lot of searching going on. Young people are realizing their problems. The older people are realizing their problems. It was okay for a while. I don't say they have solutions yet, but they understand their problems. They're searching. And when they see quality, they notice. They recognize. They do. I was at a wedding recently where, one of these weddings where there were lots of speeches. Very, very Haredi. Very, very Haredi, as you call it. And my brother was going to speak, and I was going to speak. And the first guy spoke, you can imagine, you know what these things are like. And everybody's eating and everybody's making a noise and he's trying to speak. Nobody can hear what he's saying. What he's saying is not necessarily worthy of being heard. And he sits down and everybody can. And then the next one gets up and the next one gets up. So then my brother and I got into a discussion, who of us should speak first? Because we realized we were both going to be like from another planet. So we decided that I would speak first, and I was very nervous, because how were these people going to respond? And how do you think they responded? In half a second of silence, people stopped, people listened, not because I had anything so great to say, just they're ready for something different. They're actually ready for something different. But if you look too different to start with, they're not even open. So sometimes it might be necessary. I'm not arguing that you should change anything. I'm just saying, if and when you have to, it's not a big deal. What is important is that you retain your own authenticity. that if you do that, that you keep even in the clothing, the way you present yourself, the way you act, the way you speak, the way you behave, that that never changes. That there you stay the same all the time.
You basically saying it's a direct heretz if you go to like one of the yeshivas where they wear.
That is their heritage, to conform within, you know, within it. Provided conforming doesn't compromise who you are, and you can still express your individuality in the way you act and the way you behave, it's a much bigger compliment for people to say you're special and different when you look the same than when people say you're special and different when you look different. And the focus has to be on the pneumius, because that's the essence of what your Rosh Hashiva taught. The focus is on the pneumius, on who you are inside. It's not about the outside. And in a sense, his emphasis of just dressing normally on the outside was to focus the inside. But you know, if the norm in a particular society in which you're functioning is different, then you make accommodation for that to whatever degree you can.
Just on an early point that the rabbi mentioned, confidence in our own our own derech. I'm quite a social person, so I'm off Shabbos as I go visiting all different kinds of shuls. I've been to Kollel even, and all different drachmas when I speak to people a lot. And I have personally been have heard people put down the yeshiva saying that it's not such a great yeshiva because they don't learn Talmud Yerushalmi. Or for example, someone asked me what yeshiva you're from. I said from the Yeshiva Gedolah, and say, are you one of those who think they've got a monopoly on Torah? And so like I've been personally insulted about the yeshiva's derech, and I spoke to the Rabbonim about it, and, like, how do you remain confident in your derech when you've got so many other people attacking it?
And what would you do if somebody said, are you one of those Jews? How do you respond?
So then I would respond quite violently. But since this is a Jew, I can't do that.
You might respond that way, or you might, as in the case of with the Jew, just respond and say, you've offended me, you've made me feel very hurt. I think you've just been over in Issa D'Oraisa, probably many. And I want you to know, I find your behavior very offensive. How do you think that leaves him feeling? That's all you have to do. You're not criticizing him, you're not attacking him, and you're not defending yourself. You're just telling him how he's made you feel. And that leaves him feeling very uncomfortable and will probably elicit an apology. And probably a little bit of a movement of making a person rethink. If you either shut down or you shut them or you become critical and defensive, you shut them down. And then you've achieved nothing. But by taking a stance of just saying, I need to tell you how I feel after you've talked. I feel disappointed that Ben Torah would be over so many Isurim without even thinking, as you've just done, and I feel very offended. And that's likely to get a person thinking, just in a very quiet, confident way.
Because if you respond the way that he expected you, you're just giving him what he expected.
Absolutely.
And you're just reassuring
Absolutely. You don't have to defend. You don't have to defend. Nothing to defend. And nor do you have to attack. But you can't leave it without the person knowing he's just caused damage. That he needs to know. That's a chayav tachiyach. You've got to tell him what he's just done. And you're not attacking him, and you're not attacking his yeshiva.
Why do we come across like that? We seem to have a monopoly on Torah. Is that a problem on our side?
That's a good question. I didn't know that you came across like that. But if you do,
David seems to. If
you do it just might be because of that divide, that sense that you have, that them and us, and instead of the view. I think it would be a very interesting thing to do, and you need to speak to Rosh Yeshivas about it too, because I certainly don't want to encourage you to do anything that they're not entirely happy with, but it might be quite an interesting approach when you say, when you start acting it out. Actually, I'm a Haredi too, and you come at it from that from that stance, then I think people will experience it a little differently too. Yeah, you should. And you should mix with them a little bit more. You know, you've got nothing to be afraid of. You should mix with them a little bit and learn with them. The best thing is to learn to have chavrusas with some of them, so that they can see what your learning is like, and that they can experience some of that, and you experience theirs. I'm not saying around them, but when you are for a Shabbos, you are at a place. Use an opportunity to learn with someone, because that's the best way that they'll see the value of who you are and what your yeshiva is and what your Rosh yeshivas are. When they see you learning, so that's something they won't be able to argue with. When I came to yeshiva, I was very disheartened when I was a kid, because in those days there weren't many overseas people in yeshivas. There were no Baalei Teshuva yeshivas, and there were no English-speaking yeshivas in Israel. You had an English yeshiva, but I wanted to go to Israel, so you could go to America for an English-speaking yeshiva, or to Israel, and there were Hebrew or Yiddish-speaking yeshivas. So in my yeshiva of 150 boys, I don't think there were more than three or four who came from English-speaking countries. And as Israelis, they had enormous bekiyas. So these guys, you know, the people who'd come from Yeshivot Tichoniot, had passed matric on 100 daf of Gemara. That means they knew 100 daf of Gemara well enough for a matric exam. Plus, they had learned more, and many were from Yeshiva Ketanah that knew more. I came from Yeshiva College, I didn't know 100 daf of Gemara. We had learned, and we had a good sense of learning, and certainly the best that was available. And we knew how to think in learning, but we hadn't covered that amount of that quantity, certainly not knowledgeably. And whenever I would say something, learn with the chavrus, and whatever I would say, no, you can't say that, there's a Tosfos on Daf Sans, and then you're like, you want to ask something else, well, clearly you haven't seen the Gemara on such and such. After a while, you kind of shut up, what can you do? And I went to my Rosh Hashiva and I said, this place just doesn't, I don't think this is for me, I just don't think I'm ready for this yet. And we talked. And he said, next time they say that, just ask them to open up the Tosfos. And you will see that if you learn that Tosfos through with them, they didn't understand it in the first place. And just try that over and over again. That's what I started doing. No, you can't say it because it's a Tosfos. I said, really? Let's have a look at the Tosfos. So that was already a thing. And then we would have a look at the Tosfos. Really, we'd go through the Tosfos, you know, like the Israelis tend to do. In 2 seconds, sorry, my Hebrew is not that good. I don't know. Let's just go through it a bit more slowly. Ask a couple of questions. Oh, yes, he didn't think of this. He didn't think of that. All of a sudden, we're learning that Tosfos. When we finished that learning Tosfos, now let's go to what I said in the beginning. Why did you say I couldn't say it because of this Tosfos? And actually, you could. So what I'm saying is, when you engage with people and engage with them in your area of strength, you can't just wash that away. If you don't allow yourself to be intimidated, you learn. And I think that grows the name of the yeshiva. It doesn't. As people experience your learning, that just grows the name of the yeshiva. Again, I'm not suggesting you go out and for us to start learning with everybody. I'm just saying, when you do, when you are with somebody, suggest you pull out a piece of Gemara. Learn with them.
If you see me like what you did just now, we've brought to like an all a level playing field, if you want to put it that way. That we, in fact, I mean, obviously we've known that, but it's all the same. Then what is that defining factor? You know, at least when we're giving advice to other people, or you know, when one is choosing a path to take, or a yeshiva to learning, or you know, in general, what is it if we are, you know. Everyone's after that, you know, how to learn a daf Gemara at the end of the day, then what should be that defining factor?
You've got to ask what's important to the person. What are you looking for? What do you want in yeshiva? So if I want to know how to learn a blat Gemara, I personally don't know of any yeshiva better than yours in the world. There may well be. I'm not saying there aren't. I don't know all the yeshivas in the world, but I don't know how to learn Shat in a daf Gemara with clarity. I don't know of a yeshiva that's better. So if that's what you want, that's one thing. Do you want to integrate your learning of Torah with a world view that is easy to handle in the world? That's something your yeshiva is strong in. Do you want a strong emphasis on Ben Adam LeChaverah? That's something that your yeshiva is strong in. You've got to check with the person what they're after. The person wants to be in a big chabura with a lot of learning going on, and you want to go to one of the big places, because you can't give that. It says it. In business also, it's important not to try and compete in the things you're not strong at. Does that mean that there's some people you won't attract? Yes. That there's some people that you like that wouldn't think of going anywhere else. So just be conscious about marketing the strengths, because this yeshiva has some amazing, amazing strengths, world-class strengths, absolutely world-class strengths. And those are the strengths that you want to market. Now, not everybody's looking for that. Not everybody wants that. Not everybody can handle that. So they must go somewhere else. What I even think, and I haven't had a chance to talk to the Rosh Yeshivas about it, but I think you could be marketing overseas. I think that there are a lot of yeshiva bokrim overseas and school leavers overseas who, if they knew, really understood what this yeshiva offers, and I'm not suggesting getting on a marketing campaign, there's no need to. But I'm just saying, if there was more of an awareness overseas in the United States and maybe even in England, probably in America mainly, I think that in terms of what you offer, what this yeshiva offers, there aren't yeshivas in America that offer the same. And I think there would be people that would be interested in coming out for a while. And that's why I say you need to be confident in what you've got. There are very, very few yeshivas in the world, if any, that offer what your yeshiva offers. Which is part of the reason that Moshe is here, not just because you're all such nice guys and you've been so good to him, and that he likes it, he's here because I really believe that for the learning, the foundations of learning, I don't know, there might be, I'm sure there are, I just don't know of a place that is anywhere near as good.
Would that be because of the change of
direction? Where overseas, you mean with other yeshivas?
Yeah.
I mean, for a long time there haven't been that many yeshivas that are good at pshat. It just hasn't. There are not that many yeshivas that are good at pshat. I mean, that's been so for a long time. And this yeshiva is. And balance. I think balance is another thing that you can market. Just a balanced personality. A yeshiva that produces a balanced personality. With a deep ability to analyze and understand, a very rational place of view, where you use your head to get to conclusions. It's quite important to have very clear in your mind what the differentiating qualities are of your yeshiva, and to feel very confident about that because you know that you're one of the best in the world in those areas.
I think that comes back to like the question I think I was asking: if a person did have to, how would you say, market those elements, that's exactly why our Rosh Hashiva and that Rosh Hashiva personified. That when you get a person who's, I think it comes from the Western world, if a person's looking to become religious, they don't see this as religious. They do see this as a perfect person or an ideal to go to, but you don't, because everything has to be to extremes today. Wants to come.
Well, not no one. Many do. So you will attract a certain type of person. But bear in mind also, there are now people who are getting disillusioned with that. Yeah, there's a bit of a pendulum swing back. And you might start finding there are more people, young people particularly, who are saying, I don't know that that's what I want. I would like something that feels more balanced. And you might find that there's actually more of an interest in it than there used to be. Yeah.
Okay. In the Jewish Report this week, a rabbi in Israel wrote a letter. He lives in Alon Shpot in Israel. He wrote a letter in response to some of the rabbonim in South Africa who have been, you know, the whole issue of the remaining in South Africa and that, you know, we are going through a depressive time at the moment with whatever it is with the power outages and certain issues and whatever it is, and you know, and the rabbis obviously remain very positive about it. And in response to that, he entitled it that everything will not be okay in South Africa. And again, and he brought obviously, you know, it's brought quite often about comparing the situation, you know, pre Holocaust, you know, and the Torah world that was, you know, in Volozhin with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and then at Siv, and then, you know, also he went on to say, do we think that are we so arrogant to say that we, you know, we should be protected more? Because, so I'm saying, what, in the rabbi's opinion, what's from that aspect, what should our general feeling be towards it? How seriously should we be thinking about issues like that, especially with our, you know, wanting to build the yeshiva and still viewing our, you know, learning as the best option for us. what should our response to be to these kind of, you know, because again, obviously he would be very much, that rabbi was right, he would, you know, have a lot even more to say on a yeshiva that, you know, that's building up in South Africa, and that, you know, wanting to, you know, so what should our, you know, as the Talmudim there, what should we be, what does Rabbi think our response to that should be, what we should be thinking about those kind of
things? We can't know the future, and we don't know what will be in this country. I think to compare it to Nazi Germany is just silly. And particularly for somebody who's not here. Is the rabbi who's ever visited?
He's not having an agenda.
I just think that that's a silly comparison. But the we don't know what will be, and each person has to make their own decisions about where they are. But one thing is for sure is that the that as long as there's a community here, having a yeshiva of this caliber here is an incredible contribution. You know, should this yeshiva one day, you know, Mashiach comes, I'm sure it'll transpose somewhere else. It'll transpose before, you know, that the Rosh Yeshivas will have to decide as they look forward and as things unfold where to direct it and where to lead it. But right now, this is where it is, and this is where you choose to learn. There's no immediate danger, other than crime. There's no immediate danger. So it's like people were going to Eastern Europe to learn. They didn't choose by country. People didn't say, I would like to learn in Lithuania, or I would like to learn in Poland. They decided what yeshiva they wanted to learn. You decide by the yeshiva, and the Rosh Yeshiva, that's how you choose a yeshiva. And if you would say to yourself, if this yeshiva was in New York or in Yerushalayim, I would go there, then go there in Johannesburg. What's the difference where it is? You've got to look at it as for what it is. Unless you need the social scene of Yerushalayim or whatever it is, that's a different thing. Johannesburg can't give that. But if you value the yeshiva, and you would choose this yeshiva if it was somewhere else, then you choose it here. Unless there's a sakona, and at the moment there's no, other than crime, which is a worry, and you guys need to be careful.
My history, it isn't very good, but I think you want to relate that, as far as I know, and what I was taught to think, that pre-Holocaust there wasn't, there wasn't the seeing danger at all either. I mean, it was something that, again, they won't bring reasons from that.
Yeah, but the Eretz Yisrael could also go bang.
Yeah.
If you're going to compare anything to pre-Holocaust, I mean, Eretz Yisrael is more of a danger. Said we believe in the Nisim of Eretz Yisrael, but we know we've lost Eretz Yisrael twice before. And do the people in Eretz Yisrael think they're bigger tzaddikim than they were in the time of the Beis Hamikdash? Maybe yes, maybe no. So I don't think we can play. I don't think we can play with those things too easily. We don't know. All you can do is keep your eyes open, watch the horizons, see if things start turning sour. But there hasn't been any sign of it here, other than, you know, whether you're going to say that things are going to deteriorate and new government, and you know, that those are things that you can put to talk about, like some danger to the Jewish people. Doesn't seem to be anything like that at the moment. Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So was that helpful at all?
Definitely.
You know what I find really astonishing is you can plant, you have a conversation with a doctor or a lawyer, and you'll say something absurd to him, or you'll say, I want to see that article, I want to see the doctor or the scientist to prove that, it just doesn't make sense, I want to see the proof of it. You can say to the same guy in religion that you saw your rabbi flying on a carpet to shul this morning, and you'll say, wow, that's incredible. You tell him something absurd, and you'll say, wow, that's incredible. You tell him anything, and you'll say, Jesus.
No,
the guy always loses his brains in religion.
He does, sure they do lose their brains in religion. And that's one of the things the yeshiva stands for, is using your brains in religion. So that's one of these are the strong things. I'm not saying these things for marketing purposes, they're for marketing to yourself. You need to know what the yeshiva is really strong at and what you can't easily find elsewhere. And these are some of these are some of the qualities. When you talk about clothing, that Rebellia told my father that he saw Rabbi Yisrael Salanter when he was a young boy, when Rebellia was a young boy, and my father asked him, "What stood out in your mind when you saw Rabbi Yisrael Salanter? What stood out in your mind?" And Rebellia said he was far. He was a young boy, and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was standing far away, so he couldn't see a whole lot. But what really stood out in his mind is he was dressed like a businessman. Looks like a balabos. You've got to get beyond the stuff. You've got to see your Rosh Hashivas for who they are. You've got to promote your Rosh Hashivas for who they are. You've got to be who you are. And just whatever's, it's just not a big deal. It's just not really very relevant. Moshe?
Well, Rosh Hashiva often records the story. It's a good story about Rav Lezer Gordon's father, who was a brandy maker. And he was a Talmud of Rav Chaim Volozhin. He used to walk into the yeshiva and for something. And it looked, apparently, it looked funny. He wasn't like a regular yeshiva. And Rav Chaim used to stand up for him.
So wearing a workshop's coat.
Yeah, like a sheepskin dress. So getting beyond the clothes isn't something
you need. Yeah, you just got to get beyond the clothes. But both ways. See, what I'm worried about is that you're getting as hung up on the casual clothes as they are on the other stuff. You're making a uniform out of the casual clothes. That's what I'm worried about. Don't make a uniform out of that either. It's just not important. Thank you. Yeah, we are getting